I can do economics too.
You can do a lot of things. You can do a lot of things, but you are always brilliant when it comes to connecting dots between these different fields. So can we maybe start? And it's really sad that we need to do that because there's so much violence at the moment, international violence. But can you give us a bit of an update of your reading on where the Iran war is going? Because it seems to me Donald Trump's not very happy with it anymore, is he?
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. Iran war ended. What day are we on right now? Iran war ended 14 days ago because Trump has told us that he's beaten Iran. Iran has nothing. Iran doesn't do anything. Iran, I don't know why they haven't surrendered because, he pummels Iran totally out of existence every single day. And by the way, anything that's burning that's not Iranian is all artificial intelligence. That's what we heard yesterday from Trump, that it's all artificial intelligence. And if the media is going to be putting that out on the news, they're going to get punished for it because it's fake news. It's all false news.
Very desperate, isn't he? Like with all of the statements that he's making. I mean, on Truth Social, in front of the camera, they're sounding so desperate now. I mean, trying to enlist the Europeans and Chinese and Japanese in reopening the Strait of Hormuz. It's an insane idea to start with.
I don't think that was trying. I think that was more like ordering the vassals, including the Chinese are supposed to be vassals too. They'll have it really bad if they don't do what the God Emperor the demands. You're right. And plus, if you look at his posts, they're getting longer and more babbling. I do believe the stress is. I think he was already starting at least early stages of dementia. You can look at the from his first term, and you can look at the beginning of his second term, the way he spoke. He spoke using much simpler words, simpler phrases, and he sounded more like about a 13 or maybe a 12-year-old kid or 11-year-old kid than an adult. I'm not saying he was ever the wisest or smartest man around, unless you ask him personally, or those that that believe he's the anointed one. You could see the degradation, the mental degradation, and if you're already going down that path, massive strain, especially massive strain where you're looking at the end of your presidency, you're looking at a lot of other problems. Yeah, that's gonna add to it. That's seriously mental degradation. And he's babbling. I mean, it's his Truth Socials, he's babbling because he doesn't have a filter. He needs to have a filter. He needs to have a manager that is it takes the what he wrote and goes, no, we'll erase this and this. He needs an editor or filter. But he doesn't have one, so it goes by Trump's brain to your screen. And when he's out on stage, he's babbling. He's getting worse. I mean, I listened to Hexeth's speech. I've never heard so much crap and lies compounded in such a small amount of time. And I don't think the man said a single word that was true, except maybe an A or an is. Just a pack of lies, but all those lies are to cover his own skin and back up Trump. And it's hilarious in one way, but it's very sad in another and very dangerous. You have a guy that's, your leadership is that mentally degenerating, in front of you.
And on the other side, we have, doctors and multiple PhDs, Mr. Araghchi, Mr. Ali, not Abu Nima, sorry, Ali Sade, what's his name? Sorry. Ali. I forgot his name. Abu Sadeh? Ali Sadeh? Mm-hmm. We've got the president, Pezeshkian, and so on. I mean, all of these people are keeping it incredibly together, and they're also giving a lot of interviews online, right? And they're speaking very coherently about the war goals and the implementation of it. And every time there was just a new interview out on Sky News where the guy tried to push him into, when are you going to start negotiating? The Iranians keep saying, like, no, force the other side to stop. But they give these interviews in Tehran and invite the US and foreign media in, and they're not afraid at all of doing this also out in the public in the West. I mean, how are you reading this situation?
Well, it's first of all, it's bravery. I mean, let's call it what it is. It's bravery. I don't see too many American present leaders or Western European leaders that would risk their lives, literally risk their lives, going in a parade while the U.S. is dropping bombs on the edges of it around it. I'm actually surprised the U.S. didn't commit mass murder on one of these quad parades. I was expecting that. I think in Tehran, only one woman was killed and a couple people were injured. Because they're dropping around the edges, you know, it says a lot that they actually had that much restraint and just didn't massacre that crowd. You see these leaders that they go to Kyiv, and for the life of me, I don't understand why Moscow allows it, because Moscow allows it. They coordinate with Moscow. They're coming into Kyiv. No, they coordinate their trip in so nothing is flying in their direction. I always said, you know, wait till they're about 20 minutes out from the airport, start hitting the airport. Scare them a bit, at least. Or, you know, if they're on a train, blow up the rail line ahead of them a couple kilometers so they'll stop and blow it behind them and let them walk their way out. They'll get the message real quick. They haven't actually touched them. But they know they're not going to be touched. They got Russian guarantees. That's why they go in there. You know, it's the whole plethora of stars and of Western politics and Hollywood. They're all coming in to have their little vacation tour in Kyiv with Zelensky. And by the way, according to USAID, at least the few documents that were really published, majority was never published, believe me. Julie, she got like $1 million for that trip. Angelina Jolie, the first one, got $1 million. All of these guys are getting paid handsomely for it. So that's the difference. They know they're not going to get hit versus people that are walking out. Literally, they don't know if they're ever going to get home, but this is their people and they're showing bravery. And then you look at Netanyahu, if he's still alive, he goes in a bunker, in the main bunker, which is, by the way, if it's the same bunker, it's underneath a hospital. So a little bit of human shields with your own people. Well, his wife and son, 29-year-old son, are off living a good life in Miami. Yeah, this is Western leadership. This is the modern Western leadership. They make a good show of things and virtue signaling, but they're not going to risk their own necks. That's a huge difference.
Hey, very brief intermission because I was recently banned from YouTube. And although I'm back, this can happen anytime again. So please consider subscribing not only here, but to my mailing list on Substack. That's pascalotta.substack.com. The link's going to be in the description below. And now back to the video. Do you put any faith into these kind of rumors that are circulating at the moment that Netanyahu might be dead? Because we have seen like weird videos of him coming out with six fingers and we haven't seen him like credible evidence of him for like a week or two. Do you think anything of this could be remotely reality?
Oh, you mean like when he was drinking coffee, except he didn't have any of his wrinkles were all gone. He had the skin as smooth of a like a little baby, when the coffee wasn't disappearing and wasn't slushing around, and all these other images that his teeth kept disappearing. And
all of this can just be trolling of him, right? But he's somewhere tucked away in a bunker, which, I mean, let's be honest, that would be the sane thing to do. But what?
I don't know. I can't comment on that because I simply don't know. I mean, the videos are AI fake. That's obvious enough. That's become memes. That's obvious enough. Is he actually alive? I don't know. But you know, even if he's gone to whatever just rewards he's gotten somewhere, hopefully that's nice and warm. For all the murder he's spread, there's others in line. I mean, this even if they got him, they didn't get the rest of the government. And again, just like any government, an established government, it's not a one-man party. There's other people involved. He may be the head, he may be the thinking group, but there's probably someone ready to take his place. That's how most governments run. They run on redundancy, human redundancy.
Right, right.
That's your ninja.
Just like the Iranians can't be taken out by killing Ayatollah Khomeini, you cannot take out Israel by taking out just Mr. Netanyahu. By the way, the man I was referring to earlier is Ali Larijani, the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council of Iran. You know, these are highly capable people. And now, where do you think they're taking this war now? Like, the Strait of Hormuz is basically, the Iranians have said they are not completely closing it, right? I mean, ships of friendly nations can pass. They said so. The Iranians actually still have their own oil tankers that that pass. So the U.S. really has anything but complete control over the region. Where is the war militarily going?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Iran, over the last, 18 days, has actually exported about 10% more oil than it normally does over such a period. Go figure out that one. And yesterday, there was a Pakistani tanker that was slipped by, was allowed to go through and go to Pakistan with the oil. So, yes, oil's actually still getting out. And the Saudis are getting some oil out through their pipeline to the Red Sea. But again, the vast, vast majority isn't going anywhere. And a lot of it's been damaged. Infrastructure's been damaged. The U.S., when Trump said megalomaniously, I did not destroy the oil infrastructure on Carver Island. Well, first of all, that's not the only port Iran has. Iran has five ports. It's just the main one for oil. But he didn't do that, too, because Iran already said, if you take ours out, we'll take out everybody's. You know, it's if we go, we take everybody's infrastructure with us. And then what do you do when it's really destroyed? And the damage that's there already is going to take a while to fix, like it or not. That's how it is. And I think another thing nobody talks about, you know, the U.S. dropped its citizens there, survived the best you can. Well, Saudi Arabia, all these areas, a very large chunk of the oil workers, you know, we're talking engineers, we're talking about highly skilled technicians, were Americans, or are Americans. So a lot of them with their families. You think they're going to come back to that region? Hell no. So you're going to have a very big deficit in capable workers that are knowledgeable and capable of working these facilities. Nobody's talking about that. That's a little further down the line, but that's going to be an issue too, along with a lot of other issues. So, you know, getting things back up and running to where they were before America's war of choice and aggression is going to be a lot more difficult than people think. Most people think, well, oh, the straits will open, they'll finally make peace, and everything will instantly start working. No, it won't. There'll be delays in fixing things. There'll be delays in getting people to who can fix things. There'll be delays in getting ships in and out. I mean, there's going to be a cascading effect on this. Most people don't realize it or don't think about it. But if you do a little bit of brainstorming, what else is going to happen? You know, there's a lot of issues. And that's if desalination plants don't become part of this whole game. The moment they do, the artificial entities known as the Gulf states, they all start to disappear very quickly. You may have a mass casualty event, basically people dying of thirst. And when I'm talking mass casualty, you're probably looking at 40, 50, 60 million people who may die from thirst because all those entities, they live totally out of desalination plants. Now, I was in Dubai back in 2013 on a business trip for when I was director of supply chain Eurasia for Halliburton. And I like historic places. So I was determined to go look at historic Dubai. Looked all over the internet to try to find some resources, nothing. What the hell? I got to Dubai, start talking to the locals. They're like, yeah, historic Dubai. Historic Dubai was a small mud brick fort in a tiny little village with a tiny little port. That was historic Dubai. It doesn't exist anymore. That's it. There is no historic Dubai. There's no great civilization in these areas. They're tiny little warlords with tiny little fortresses, and the vast majority of the population, which wasn't that big to begin with, were nomads. That's it. All of this is artificially built. All of this is artificially built on technologies and trade routes, which is, by the way, another point that nobody's talking about. What happens when the food runs out? Dubai, UAE, Qatar, they can't feed themselves. Saudi Arabia has wheat in the south, at least, and it still has to import a lot of food. what happens when these other countries, I mean, they should be about now running out of food. There's no imports going in. I mean, you could bring things on planes, but when you're dealing with, 4 million people you have to feed in Qatar alone, that's about 3 million workers and about 3.5 million workers, about 500,000 locals. That's a lot of planes. That type of produce gets brought in by ship.
Yep. And we are in an active war area where missiles fly around and flights are grounded. So, and, you know, people make stupid comments. I've read that in the Swiss media, you know, about people wondering whether they should try to escape from Dubai and Qatar by taxi. It's like, guys, have you looked at a map? Have you looked at where these things are? Can you, you can't just drive through a desert like you drive from Zurich to Paris. You just can't. But anyhow.
You could if you can get up to Riyadh. There are the roads all the way down to Mecca and Medina. But yeah, I mean, first of all, you need to find a taxi driver. Second of all, that's a pretty long track. Third of all, I'm not going to go into what it costs you. But there's this other point. The U.S. has dropped its civilian population there. I mean, Russia has gotten its civilians out. Georgia's gotten its civilians out, and Russia was helping and is ready to continue to help. Other countries got, the U.S. dropped its civilians there. There's no effort to get them out. As a matter of fact, you know, day two, or is it day three, I had the video in one of my updates. This journalist, he calls in a videotaping, he calls the emergency line. That was set up for this from the State Department, the Ministry of International Affairs. And there's the recording there. You know, basically, don't count on the U.S. government to get you out. Survive the best you can. Right. So the U.S. government, just never mind the 2,000-some soldiers and civilians in the green zone and the other two bases in Iraq that have been dropped. And nobody's talking about, even though there's combat operations there every single day. Sooner or later, they're running out of provisions and ammunition, and then what? And the green zone's been getting hit, and one of their Phalanx systems was destroyed 2 days ago, which is the systems, anti-aircraft, anti-missile systems that you see the little R2-D2-like units with a Gatling gun sticking out of them.
Green zone is that area in Iraq, right? In Baghdad.
Yeah, it's in Baghdad. It's a gigantic zone in the city. That's set up as a safe zone for the embassy and whomever else and corporate headquarters and such. Yeah, so one of their main defense points has been destroyed. There may be more by now. But they've been dropped. And, you know, then the people in Saudi Arabia. And believe me, if there were for Aramco or a lot of these other companies, I mean, I had a job offer for Aramco. Professors, they're there from America. They're, you know, managers from different companies. Things like that. There's a lot of people. It's not just oil and gas. And they're there with their families. They've all been dropped. Survive the best you can. The U.S. could have formed convoys and get them to Jordan, at least, and then fly them out of Jordan or down to Egypt. They could have or tried to get them up to, I guess, getting up to Turkey would be difficult. Well, I know. El Jelani is their friend now, so he'd probably let them through. But they could have done something. But they've done nothing. They've done nothing.
But they still have it better than the poor souls now stuck in these bases, the ones right at the Gulf, right? That are, and according to you, right? There's, or you're the one who told me, right? That they didn't even bother to build bunkers, proper bunkers in those bases.
Yeah, that was a shock when I found that out. I spent my time in armor and infantry, besides the headquarters units. Everybody, all officers go into staff sooner or later. But as an armor officer, as an infantry officer, the fact that they didn't build bunkers is mind-boggling. What do you mean they didn't build bunkers? I was talking to a friend of mine. I was doing an interview with a friend of mine, Pazi Apoladze, who is pretty high up in Georgian society. And he's a former infantry officer, first Soviet and then Georgian. He's like, well, what do you mean? I didn't hear you right. Like, you heard me right. What do you mean? It's the same thing. Everybody from our background just go, what? But yeah, they didn't build bunkers. One, they were expecting this war to be very, very short. And two, they were absolute reliance and faith in the anti-air systems. Well, the anti-air systems at best are out of ammunition, or worse, were destroyed along the way. And what I've heard is now there's panic. The Saudis have told the American military, go screw yourself. We're not helping you. We're neutral. Survive the best you can. So that's, you know, they're cut off from that. There's talk about evacuating the bases, mass evacuation, because they, and go where, I don't know, plead for the Saudis to let them pass, because those bases are absolutely untenable. The Iranians are systematically destroying the infrastructure. They haven't started really working over the barracks and places like that yet, but they'll get to that sooner than later. But these guys, yeah, they don't have bunkers. They didn't plan for this. It's insane. I mean, it, like I said, from somebody in my background, it's like, well, how do you not build a bunker? You start digging bunkers the moment you decide where your base is going to be. You start digging bunkers and you start building everything else. You know, even Halliburton, Schlumberger, these types of companies in Iraq and other areas like that, they have bunkers on their bases. But yeah, the Air Force and the Navy types, they never build bunkers, which is insane. There may be some bases have bunkers, but as far as I know, they don't, which, again, is insane. But now they're suffering their stupidity. What do? You got no place to hide.
And now this morning, we also had like a report that they're actually, I think it's the Gerald Ford, right? The aircraft carrier that has been out on the sea now for 10 months. And that they actually had a fire. They're saying the fire broke out in one of the laundry rooms, like from the laundromats, drying stuff. Anyhow, fire on board, took him a while, 3 hours to put it out. Let's suppose all of that is true, and this is not external damage, but you know, this thing is now starting to burn just without even being attacked. And apparently 600 sailors are impacted by that, because their quarters got kind of flamed up. What does that tell us about the state of also the U.S. Navy? I mean, they seem to be really strained, like heavily strained. And Donald Trump is now ordering more people into the Indian Ocean, apparently. Alexander Mercurius is interpreting this as maybe not so much being about the Strait of Hormuz and more about trying to intercept Iranian oil tankers. But that's just a good wild guess. Where do you see this going?
Well, you remember what I was telling you before about cascading systems. This is all part of it. I mean, an aircraft carrier, first of all, you know, aircraft carrier is big. And there's 5,000 people aboard. And they've been out to sea for 11 months, and which is a massive strain on the human body, on the human mind. But it's a big place. Now, look at those destroyers. They've been out there as escorts just as long. They've got crews of about 350 people. On a much smaller piece of real estate, you know, they're even more cooked up. Nobody's talking about those destroyers or submarines that are there, but all those systems are highly technical systems, are dependent on each other, and yeah, the crews are strained. I mean, think about it: being 11 months out to sea, normally they're on 6 month rotations. 11 months, I mean, is insane. They haven't been to port in 11 months. It's a massive mental, physical strain on people. You know, if they've done stops, it's very short stops to refuel, reprovision. But you know, people need a break. Physically, people need a break. You know, this is just civilians. A guy that had 5 deferments for Vietnam, Trump, 5 deferments. The guy that said, you know, the people that ran Vietnam were all fools, they were all idiots, they didn't know what they're doing. Master tactician Trump, who had 5 deferments, could have shown everybody what he was capable of, become an officer. Of course, he didn't, he wouldn't, and he won't, and neither will any member of his family. But, you know, this is abuse of just abuse of people. Just even if it wasn't combat ops, but this wasn't an illegal war, this is just an abuse of people. You keep them out there, you know.
This is the situation even before these assets are now being used. I mean, we're talking about this being a huge disaster for the United States now in the first half of week 3, but they didn't even go to combat yet. I mean, the state of the U.S. Military forces seems to be really much worse than we thought, I mean, even us critical folks were like, ah, they're not going to be able to project that much force, but that they would project that much weakness is a huge surprise to me.
You know, Tsakhal, or the idea of Tsakhal as a Russian, the idea was supposed to be the premier military force in the Middle East. That is, until they went into Gaza and they proved that they weren't. They're far, far from it. You know, the thing about being a bully on any yard is you really tend to not get into fights. You may get one or two fights to establish your reputation. And occasionally you may beat up on somebody small enough to keep that, quote, reputation. But you really don't want to risk fighting anybody that can actually do damage to you. Because even if you beat them, the damage they've done to you is going to show the rest of everyone around you in that yard that, hey, he's not invincible. He's actually taken quite a few hits. You know, maybe I could take him, or maybe two or three of us can take him. Because look, he's got cracks in his armor. And that's exactly what the IDF showed in Gaza. And went in there, it killed a lot of people. But 2 years later, and, you know, they're still fighting. They haven't been broken. And that shows you that, yeah, the IDF wasn't the big bad boys that everybody feared. They got themselves bogged down in South Lebanon. Sure, they're good at killing civilians, but they're not very good at fighting. And that's what the U.S. is now showing. Yeah, well, sure, little countries, we can beat up on them. A regional power is absorbing everything we're given and is smacking us back. And this infrastructure the U.S. built up over 30 years, it's gotten demobilized and degraded, basically destroyed, really in the first 4 or 5 days. And now Iran is just systematically disassembling whatever is left. And there's nothing the U.S. can do about it except sit there and take it.
So what are they actually targeting? I didn't exactly follow, because it's actually difficult to know. Like the United States and Israel, they don't exactly put that on the evening news, like what kind of facilities came under attack. But what do you know from your sources, what the Iranians are going after? And also, the Iranians, the first 2 weeks, they just used their old missile stockpile, which is also quite fantastic. And recently, they started using their newer ones, including loitering missiles, whatever that means, but apparently even harder to somehow intercept. Can you give us an update on that front?
Yeah, it's loitering munitions. Russia's been using those since day one. You put up a missile into the air and it just flies around because it's got enough fuel capacity. It flies around looking for a target. So you're not sending, you don't necessarily know what you want to hit. You're looking for a target of opportunity. So it's flying around while you've got drones or you've got infantry recon units out there in the bush. Obviously, that doesn't work quite well in the Persian Gulf that way. But you've got drones looking for a target, and you've got munitions already in the air. So you see a target, say a tank, or you see a staff car, or some of that. If it's normally, you see it, you call it, they launch. He may be far away by the time you get a chance to destroy him. Here, you see him, you call it, and there's a munition that's already flying around, and it just goes in and takes it out. So you get a very fast response time. Like I said, Russia's been working with those for the last 4 years, very effectively. So that's one thing. Yeah, they're fighting. What we're seeing with this, they're going into phase 3. So phase 1 was cheap old, well, not cheap, but necessarily old stuff and older drones, old ballistics that were 15, 20 years old. They used them not to saturate the enemy anti-aircraft. That's phase 2. They use them to blind the West, or not the West in this case, the U.S. And the Israelis, by taking out all those radars and constantly hammering the THAAD radars, which, by the way, 4 days ago, or 5 days ago now, videos came out of South Korea as they were in the night sneaking them out to get them onto, I guess, planes and fly them over to Israel. So they're stripping their assets out everywhere now. Thanks for pissing China off and North Korea for South Korea. We're gone. Bye-bye. Have a good life. We'll be back when this is over, maybe. And the same thing for Japan while we're at it. You know, thanks for being our patsy, and we're gone now, so we'll see you when this is over, which can't leave those leaders in high spirits. It's like, well, yeah, you know your place in the big hierarchy of things. Israel rules.
Just on a side note, the Japanese took the decision 2 years ago to start building their own missile defense system. They just knew it would take 10 years. So it's like, yeah, you're about 8 years late. But it was well understood already 2 years ago. And that was not because of U.S. pressure. It was because they understood the U.S. is not reliable. But anyhow, completely different theater. Please, let's continue with what's being hit and what the three phases are. So phase two, then... overwhelming the U.S. System.
So the U.S. What happened was the time of preparation for an attack went from being around 45 minutes to down to maybe 5 minutes, because these forward radar stations have been destroyed, right? So the forward eyes are gone. That those radars would actually pick up the launch. So the moment the missile started to launch, they're ready to pick it up on the scan. So if it's heading toward Israel or heading toward an American bases further in, you know, they've got 45 minutes to react to it. That's a huge amount of time. Now there's no radars to pick anything up. The FADs have been destroyed in Saudi Arabia. In other words, they're destroyed in Jordan. There is no pickup. By the time you're seeing them coming in, they're 5 minutes out. Your reaction time is obviously minimal. So a lot of stuff starts to get through. It's a phase two. You're still launching a lot of older stuff. I mean, you're going further distance in, but now you're using it to soak up and overwhelm the anti-aircraft systems. Because not only are you sucking up missiles that are being launched to destroy your older stuff, but when they're launching, the radars are switching on. When the launchers are launching, they're identified where they're at, and any follow-on drones or secondary wave is now targeting those platforms. So now you're also destroying the actual anti-aircraft system infrastructure, not just using up their missiles. So you're doing both and degrading. And once that's effectively done, then you go over to your expensive stuff. That's when you pull the good toys out and start whacking key infrastructure that would normally be defended. And that's what we saw Hezbollah shoot off 200 missiles. That normally they wouldn't do something like that as many, because they'd be intercepted. But they did it, and they flew mostly unarmed to their destination. This is where we're at now. And there's nothing the U.S. has that can stop this. There's nothing Israel has. Its systems are overwhelmed. Its munitions are at minimal critical levels. And as far as infrastructure in the Persian Gulf, and we saw those five tankers burning. This is what Iran is doing. And you have somewhere, I don't know where, I couldn't even guess from where, they're getting satellite imagery. Because, you know, Donald Trump, by the way, has ordered all U.S. satellite companies to scrub everything for the last 2 weeks and not give out anything. So at least give it out with a two-week delay. So the American companies are offline. But I don't know where they're getting them. But they seem to be... Apparently, not only does Iran have a couple satellites, but other countries on Iran's site have satellites. Hundreds of satellites. I don't know. I didn't expect that. I just thought I don't understand what's happening. This wasn't supposed to be that. I mean, and possibly Russia is proxying the U.S.? How dare they? I mean, only America gets to proxy Russia. It can't go the other direction.
That's coming.
Absolutely. I'm shocked. I'm telling you, I'm shocked. Shocked I am.
I'm sorry, we should not focus on Donald Trump, because it's a decoy. It's like it's a distraction from what's actually happening. But the last video on Twitter that I watched about his press conference before we went online is him saying that no expert could have foreseen that the Iranians would strike the countries that host U.S. military bases. That's came out of the blue. Nobody could expect that. It's the level. I mean, okay, it's a distraction from what's really happening. It's just fantastic that stuff is out there. So we've got all of this cooperation going on. We've got the targeting. We also learn now in the third week that, again, the Iranians were not only able to do this three-tiered attack strategy. But, you know, with the US pounding them, and they were pounded, they were also struck, but nowhere near enough in order to take away the capacity to do so. So the Iranians maintain the capability. And every single day, the Pentagon is actually telling us, Hegseth is telling us that all of the war-making capacity of Iran had been destroyed, 95%, 96, 97. And still, these things keep flying. So this tells us a lot about the actual capacity of the Iranians, the Iranian military, doesn't it?
Well, what it tells you is that devious Russia has gone over from washing machines to refrigerators to get the working chips and coffee makers and you know everything else. That's how we're feeding Iran and their technology and keeping their drones flying. That's right, because you know Russia was out of missiles and ammunition 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago.
That's going to shuttle the motor lane. Yep.
Yeah, and shovels, deadly shovels. I mean, it's hypersonic shovels. So that technology has been shared. Iran is now moving into the next generation of hypersonic shovels. God help us all. They have multiple warhead shovels on some of these ballistic missiles, as we've seen over Israel. You know, that's when a whole dozen shovels come flying at you at once. But,
and you know, for anyone.
And the latest insult is, to try to undermine the Iranian government is Khamenei is gay. That's the best they can come up with. That literally is now the line they're rhyming because that will cause a revolution.
These people, you look at it, it's kindergarten at its best.
No, but it's really difficult. It's really difficult for us to keep a straight face. And everybody, if you're listening and you don't get the shovel reference, then you're probably a very, very statistically unlikely to be on this channel because you're probably too young. But I mean, there's just so much cynicism that we had to endure the last 4 years. And it really seems that, you know, we were talking about this, right, in earlier episodes with other colleagues, that the West started believing its own lies. And this is the moment when it all comes crashing in. The fact that they did believe their own lies led them not only into the Ukraine proxy war, but now into the Iran war. And it turns out Iran is nothing like it was portrayed. And even the people, like really senior people in serious positions, not just Trump, but below Trump, within the military structures, seem to have believed the lies that they told themselves.
You know, like I said, the three big things that came out of yesterday is from the U.S. is A, no more images from satellites. B, it's all AI. And C, Khamenei's gay. That's it.
Did they actually say that?
Yes. C, because he's gay and you have to have a revolution. It's on X. It's on other platforms. Yes, absolutely. This will cause a revolution. We killed all of that didn't cause a revolution. Let's see, brainstorm quickly. What else have we got? This is the epitome of U.S. intelligence and the PR spin, I guess, at this point in this conflict. This is how ludicrous they're getting. This is you know, there's grasping at straws, and there's grasping at thin air. And this is the level they've gotten. This is the best they can do. He's gay.
But if you're that far in, at the beginning of week number three, we're that far into this desperation. Doesn't that mean that we are getting really dangerously close to maybe seeing a first nuke being used?
From the U.S., no. From Israel, maybe. Of course, if Israel, I missed one else. I'm sorry. There was point four. Everybody must come here and help us open the Straits of Hormuz. We're not going to do it ourselves because that's dangerous. So bring your ships and do it. I'm sorry, that was the fourth point. I'll have all that up in my update. So yeah, that was the fourth point. I'm sorry, I cheated everybody 25% of the points. So it's fake, no imaging, he's gay, and it's your duty to open the Straits of Hormuz. That's the takeaway for the last 2 days. It's like, really? This is how far it's all sunk. This is, well, you know, whatever his personal life, I'm pretty sure that's not going to affect the war effort at this point. Nobody else is gonna come save your behinds in the in there. Everybody went, ah, thanks. We'll think about it next year. And part of that threat, plea slash threat was things will get bad for NATO if you don't come do this now.
So I mean, how tell me, you, because you're sitting there, like, how's the Russian media reporting all of this? I mean, they must be having the time of their lives now, right?
Oh yeah, it is. The Russian, I don't watch too much television. I don't have time. Actually, I watch almost no television. I don't have physical time, but I read a lot of the stuff that comes out. And yeah, they're having a field day with it. I mean, this is the ludicrousness of all of this is just the degradation of all of this is amazing. I mean, it's not that the king doesn't have any clothes on; he doesn't have any skin on. I mean, he's gelded and he doesn't have any skin on. You know, at this point, to make it a little crude, if he cuts and runs now, you may have part of his gonad still attached to him. The longer he stays, the more gelded he becomes, because there is no way to win outside of nuking, and then you go into a whole different era that you don't really want to go into. Possible counter nukes from some of the Muslim states that have nukes. And by the way, that'll be the green flag for every country that can to either put up their own nuclear programs or buy somebody's like Pakistan's or North Korea's nukes. I mean, you're going to talk mass nuclearization of the world at that point. It's not a matter of even closing the gates after the horses have fled the barn. It's closing the gates of the barns burned down. You're still holding the gate. There's no barn. That's what it would be. And Trump would more likely be walking out in handcuffs out of the White House before it's all over, because his enemies, they're going to have a field day with him anyways. It's just how badly do you want to go down in history? Or he'd have to go full dictator mode. It's Israel on the other hand. But of course, if Israel does it, you know, Israel has a nuclear power plant. It's not a very big power plant, but it does have a nuclear power plant 100 kilometers south of Jerusalem. The point is the whole country's pretty damn small. If that nuclear power plant gets taken out, or the heating and backup electricity, the cooling and the backup electricity units get taken out, which is easy enough to see with Israel's air defense being basically degraded to almost nothing, you'll have a nuclear meltdown, and that'll still contaminate a very large chunk of a very small country. So you'd still be looking at, a huge area. It's not the majority area that's going to be radioactive to at least some degree. Yeah, and since there's not a very wet climate, you know, the big plus of a wet climate is it sooner than later, it washes out to sea.
Yeah.
If in a desert environment, it doesn't wash out to sea. And every time the wind blows, everything that's still radioactive that hasn't half-lifed itself out of existence gets blown right back into the atmosphere. And everybody gets to breathe it and eat it and drink it all over again. So yeah,
no, the best protection that Israel has against that scenario is actually the worldview of the Iranian leadership. And when I talked to Mohammad Marandi, he several times said, "Look, Pascal, this is the land of Palestine. We have no intention of poisoning Palestine." So that's good for them, but it's extremely dangerous, of course. But maybe let's talk just a little bit about not just what we can foresee, but how you think that the development also coming from Russia and coming from China, what that tells us. So 2 days ago, I had a discussion with a Chinese scholar that is not out yet, but I will put it out to Thursday or Friday this week. And he was making the point that when the war started, the Chinese were very pessimistic. And they always, he said, like, in the Chinese view, the Iranians always were too blue-eyed about the US and their ability to negotiate with them and so on and so forth. So they were very pessimistic, and they withheld a lot of some of the support that they could have given because they didn't want to bet on a losing horse. And now that the Iranians are really kind of rocking it, like in their campaigns, that he says the Chinese are becoming much more confident of also like adding more backup and also rhetorically speaking out for Iran more, which they were very hesitant to do in the beginning. Is there a similar thing happening in Russia?
Well, Russia was backing Iran as it was. Does success breed success? Of course it does. You know, the great aid to help the Soviet Union, you know, when it kicked in during the Second World War. It kicked in when the British ambassador drove up out of Moscow, drove up to Tien, which was at that point about 100 something kilometers, so 120 kilometers north of Moscow,
about 90 now.
Moscow's growing. And this is right after New Year's, and toured the death and destruction of a German division up there. It had gotten surrounded, it gotten exterminated. I mean, exterminated. And he telegraphed back to Churchill and Roosevelt, I think they're going to win. They're going to do this. And that's when Lend-Lease started coming in from the Americans, which was all paid for. And by the way, the Mongolians, dollar-wise, gave just as much as the Americans. If we're going to go down that road, they actually did. It is slightly different materials, but yeah. But success breeds success. You know, they've got a pretty damn good chance of winning this. Okay, we can back this now. Russia's been backing them as it is. That's why, you know, all the shock and awe and, oh my God, they're giving coordinates. Yeah. You didn't realize that was going to happen. But Russia is still actively also providing equipment, believe you me, that you don't train MiG-29 and Su-35 and S-400 operators and pilots in 3 or 4 months. Those people get trained for a year plus. So you do your own judgment on who's sitting behind the controls in the planes and in the S-400 system, which, by the way, has been husbanded so far. Because Americans, the B-2s have flown in to some degree. But the majority of American Israeli aircraft, including the B-52s, have not flown over Iran. It's no matter what they say about there is no air defense, there is air defense. And I know there's an S-400 system, at least one, out there somewhere waiting. So if those B-52s come flying in right over Iran, those are easy prime targets. And I'd expect to see a few of them going down. So there's that. But yeah, I think China, and from what I've heard, this may be happening. China not only seeing that Iran can be can defeat at least locally the U.S., but China is drawing other conclusions from it. So it may be celebrating a reunification before the end of this year. That's something else, because Taiwan's got to be getting real nervous about. The U.S. military has shown itself to be at what level of capability? You know, the Lincoln had to run away. I mean, you can call it what you want it, but the Lincoln had to run away. The F-35, I was talking with Colonel Wilkerson. He's got a lot of information on Lockheed Martin's prime cash cow, the F-35. First of all, the F-35, for those who don't understand what it is, it's a plane that was supposed to do everything. So it does everything really, really badly. Because, you know, planes get specialized. Huh?
Can it make coffee?
No, but it can fall out of the sky at very on the spot. I mean, if it runs out of all ammunitions, it can bomb things by just falling straight down on them. There are a couple of videos that came out with that. So it may have a coffee maker in there too, for all I know. I mean, the it gets better. Not only are they insanely expensive, Lockheed Martin by contract. On avionics, on propulsion, and certain other subsystems, in the contract has it specified that the U.S. military, and so for the military of every other country that owns them, is not allowed to service those subsystems. Only Lockheed Martin mechanics can service those subsystems at like $500-$600 an hour. Oh, and so at the service them at sea, obviously they have to be on the aircraft carrier, so you're paying, you know, I don't know, how many thousands of dollars a day per person that Lockheed Martin's making and these guys are making for being there. So yeah, that's insane, right? But what's even more insane, first of all, the plane has a maximum bingo distance of about 500 kilometers. Bingo means it has to turn around or runs out of fuel. It can't. So that's half the fuel's gone. 500 kilometers is pretty damn short. I mean, F-18, I think, is around 800 kilometers, 700 some kilometers.
That's about the distance from Tokyo to Osaka. That's not far.
Yeah.
That's only a 2-hour, 20 minutes.
Yeah. Now, if it's going, I mean, if it doesn't have to return, it can go 1,000 kilometers from point A to point B before its fuel runs out.
By the way, if you want to go and bomb Iran, then you kind of need to go back.
Yeah. You kind of want to land somewhere other than, you know, inside Iran or somewhere at the outskirts of Iran. So you have to have refueling stratoforces. Basically, the entire American air tanker fuel and a British air tanker fuel, everybody else's, is there. It's almost all concentrated there. So when they get destroyed, that's a hit. That's a pretty big hit. So basically, the U.S. has lost six of them. They're saying that some of these can be repaired, but six of them in 2 days. One got shot down, six got hit by on the ground, or five got hit on the ground. Whether that can be repaired, that's not something that's going to be happening for fire damage, you know, in 1 or 2 days. So they're combat ineffective because the aircraft carrier has to stay far enough away that it doesn't get whacked, which means it's on the other side of the of Oman. The Chinese satellites found them, and they really can't go very far in. Well, it gets better. Yes, how could it get better, Stas? Oh, strap in, it gets better. You know, the M1 Abrams as a tank, our standard rule of thumb was 1 hour exploitation, 2 to 3 hours of maintenance, which is bad, which is already bad. Russian tanks take a lot less maintenance. This thing, if what Colonel Wilkerson told me is correct, they're looking at about 10 closer to 20 hours of maintenance for every hour of exploitation. So basically, you can't fly multiple sorties with these things. You fly out once, you come back, and it's grounded for basically a day as they're trying to fix it. And I mean, talk about inefficient. This has got to be the most inefficient plane that has ever been built, ever. I mean, for its cost, for the cost of maintenance and everything else, it's incredible. I mean, just
let me get this straight. So not only does the United States not have enough of these things, and they cost a hell of a lot of money, and the production capacity of it depends on the Chinese willingness of exporting rare earths, but they're also like incredibly, they break immediately, and you need to, after 1 hour of flight, you need to 20 hours of maintenance. I mean, this is just a whole new level of like decrepit kind of military system, which I just never thought that the military industrial complex in the US was that poor in quality.
Two corrections. It doesn't necessarily mean they're break, but the whole system has to be reviewed, has to be analyzed, has to be tweaked, and someplace has to be fixed. And it takes about 20 hours to go through everything. So that seems to be what it is. Maybe Colonel Wilkerson heard it wrong, but he's got military sources, obviously. The man is very well connected, and I'm just passing on the information that he told me. As far as it's not rare earths. It's processed rare earths. U.S. has tons of rare earths. They're not that rare. There's only two of the 17 elements that are actually very, very rare. Now, they're trace elements in crystalline formations that are dominated by other minerals, by other metals, and they can be weeded out in different forms. And it's expensive, it's dirty, and China's got 97% of world capacity. Russia has 1%, and it's doubling its capacity over the next 2 years. And the rest of the world has 2%. So U.S. has what, one plant that started to do it, and Trump was showing this magnet off. Because in their pure form, they're very highly magnetic. So they're very good for electronics, particularly radar systems. Not really radar. Imaging, X-ray imaging. Some of the elements are radioactive naturally. So they're good for imaging, MRIs, you know, things like that. It all uses them in modern electronics. It's just the U.S. can't mass produce them in quantities that it needs for its missiles, guidance systems. It's planes, it's big radar balls. So they're that little bit of a problem. It's like saying, you know, the Roman legions are great. We just don't have any steel production. So our Carthage has to provide us with steel. Other than that, we'll conquer Carthage and we can keep them down. You got little problems there. This is the same thing on a more modern. And by the way, steel came before iron. Iron's a high-tech process.
Right. People don't understand.
again about the way that this war is developing. Like, how long do you think the United States can physically still maintain attacking Iran?
Well, they can continue dropping JDAMs on Iran for a long time. U.S. has a lot of dumb iron bombs, manufacturing guidance units, and glide units that are assemblies attached. It's pretty cheap, all things considered. They could do for a very, very long time. Effectiveness, big question. Public support, they never even had a rally around the flag moment that U.S. normally has when it starts these wars. And very quickly, the gas prices are heading toward, they're already, there was at least one station in California that was already at $8, but on average they're $5 plus, and they're going only going up. EU is screaming and hollering, but of course the U.S. will just ignore it. But since, you know, the U.S. could walk in and on the oil industry and put in, for at least inside the U.S., put in export controls and put in price ceilings. They could. But then the donor class would be really, really upset because they're making money off of this. I'm just wondering, you know, the reason there was so much oil in the U.S. because, oh, we've allowed Russia to sell its excess oil. We've allowed nobody to do anything. The reason Russia had excess oil, and everybody else did too, if you look at the oil charts, for about 3-4 months before this started, oil had been going downwards in price. So a lot of companies put a lot of their stock in oil that they didn't sell. They put it on ships as storage facilities, mobile storage facilities, plus, you know, land-based storage facilities, waiting for price to go up. Oh boy, our price has gone up. So my question is, Barron Trump and the rest of these guys, how much do they buy stocks and bonds in the oil industry? Good. That's happened before in other industries, and it's not limited to Trump. That's the way the U.S. government works. Insider trading is illegal for everyone except for Congress. Congress wrote itself out of that little bill, by the way. They literally have an exemption, so they know what's coming up, who's going to get the big contracts, and they buy up their stocks and get really rich. That's why Congress is full of millionaires and billionaires, even though most of them came in with upper middle class or lower upper class salaries. And they're making, and they're not making that much money as congressmen. So, you know, but yet they're all millionaires. So Congress is in the loop for that. And I'm sure, you know, who's gonna say if Trump's closest associates were buying up stocks? You know, I'm afraid if plenty of people can say it, they can't prove it. Or if they can prove it, they can't do anything about it. Because there's always, you know, amnesty. They're making money.
Yeah, no, look, war is a racket, and even a losing war is still a racket. So people still making money.
You're absolutely right, Pascal, but it's worse. It's not just a racket. War is not necessarily always a racket. Sometimes it's necessary. But most of the time it is, it at least has a good chunk of it. But the point here, too, is for the U.S. and the military-industrial complex and other companies, they don't care if they win or lose.
Right.
They don't. They're making money either way. So they're not trying to win even. It's just prolong it. Prolong it as long as possible because we're making money. That's the end of it. We'll walk away tomorrow if the money goes away. It's even worse. I mean, people making money while there's a war, but they're trying to win it. At least they're trying to win it. They're trying to get something. When the people back it don't give a damn. Two decades in Afghanistan, $7 trillion spent in Afghanistan. They didn't care if they won along. It's just they needed to extend it because they're making money off it.
Yeah, and it bears repeating, you know, the United States doesn't lose wars. There's moments when it doesn't win them, but the military-industrial complex still makes a ton of money out of it. No, I mean, the U.S. didn't lose the Vietnam War. South Vietnam lost the Vietnam War. When you're eradicated from the map, that's certainly not going to happen, and they know it, and they're going to continue profiteering on it. Stas, this was again a good update and insights. People who want to follow you, they should go to Mr. Slavic Man, Slavic with a K, on YouTube and on Telegram. Anything else there they should find you at?
Yeah, I've got a Substack, Zmi Garenich, And I'm an ex under Stana Skorpionik. We couldn't fit the whole name, but we Russians like long names. And unfortunately, I don't give you enough on there. So Stanis Skorpionik. But yeah, and Zvi Garenich, I'm using that just like you. I'm using that as a backup right now, uploading all my videos. I mean, the videos I'm uploading are older videos, obviously, right now, because I got a big backlog of them. But yeah, you never know what, if YouTube will block you or not. So
everybody find Stas now. Go on Substack, on X, on YouTube. Stas Skorpionik. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.